You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to the Hot Texas Swing Band and our friend Alex Dormont. And it wasn't even
Hot Texas.
Yeah.
Hot Texas.
Well, what do we got going
on? Oh, my goodness. We are so delighted that you're with us tonight. Have we got a show for you? This is episode 109 when you go looking for it on your favorite podcasting channel tomorrow. Here is our cast of characters tonight. Henry C. Park, film editor for True West Magazine. Henry is joining us. Hello,
Hi, Henry.
Henry. Hello. And also in the room is Craig Johnson, award-winning author of the Longmire series. He's joining us. Hello, Craig.
Good to be here. And thanks for having me.
We've been looking forward to this night since
we haven't.
Right after the Tucson Book Festival, and I think you emailed Craig, and he said, "Sure, I can be on the show." And so
I wasn't sure he ever answered an email.
He answers email if you're listening or watching. Craig Johnson will answer email.
So, which is pretty good, you know. As I always say, like, it's pretty good for a guy that like writes about a sheriff that can't like operate a cell phone, and I can answer my own emails. I'm pretty proud of that, actually.
He works off post-it notes mostly, doesn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, welcome, gentlemen. Henry, we're going to kind of start with you a little bit. What's going on in Western film and TV, and where have you been?
Well, where I've been, I'm just back from the Lone Pine Film Festival, which was, you know, four wonderful days of walking around all those crazy rocks and then watching the movies that were shot around them. And before that, I was at the Autry for their 36th anniversary block party. They very kindly had me signing, yes, the greatest Westerns ever made and the people who made them. And so I've been making the rounds and things like that. Let me just catch you folks up on what's happening in the wide world of Western movie watchers. The big topic is, when does Yellowstone return? And the answer is Sunday. The second half of season 5 begins on the Paramount Network on November 10th. And there are 6 more episodes arriving weekly. And I'd love to ask Craig something about this, if I may. When Longmire began, it was on A&E, where episodes were released weekly. And when you moved to Netflix, they dropped whole seasons at a time. Which release strategy do you prefer?
Wow, that's a loaded question there. Like, I don't know, the technology has changed a lot. Like, I mean, I'm from that old school of, like, you know, when you, like, you know, set the VCR like that, or even before that, you know, where the whole family gathered around 10 minutes before a television show started weekly like that, because you didn't want to miss any of it or anything like that. So I don't know. I mean, I know the convenience of the streaming thing is really wonderful like that. And then, of course, you know, I mean, my gosh, you know, we've been on Netflix now for like about, you know, kind of 10, 12 years or something like that. And every day I get emails from people, you know, garnering, you know, a new audience from it like that, because they can go back and they can watch it from the very first episode all the way through, you know, to the end of the final 6th season like that. And so I can understand how, you know, the streaming services work, and that it's a better business model, I think, you know, for getting out there and getting the message out, you know, and having you have a much broader audience than you've had before. I mean, the show, you know, Longmire is still like one of the top 10 to 20 shows on Netflix, for goodness sake, which is just outrageous. But I do kind of miss, you know, the almost theatrical release of, you know, like waiting till Sunday night, you know, for that show that you wanted to watch. And like, you know, centering your life around like that 1 hour a week, you know, where you would be able to like sit down and watch that. So I can see benefits from both. I guess in the modern era, I have to go streaming, but I'm kind of glad that I went through that, you know, that period in time when, you know, a television show coming on was kind of exciting.
Yeah, I do miss the time when everybody saw the same episode the same time. So the next day.
Yes. Thank you, Henry. That makes my point right there.
Yeah, yes.
Well, I should. Now, back to Yellowstone. For anyone who didn't hear, Kevin Costner will not be in it. He's been busy with Horizon. Of course, Horizon Part 1, which is a wonderful first quarter of the story, was a huge disappointment in theaters, but a huge hit on streaming. And the question is, when and how can we see Horizon Part 2? It premiered on September 7 at the Venice Film Festival, but will it get a theatrical release or go straight to streaming? For now, the only thing we know for sure is that it will get a theatrical release on April 3rd, 2025 in Germany.
Wow.
Now, has anybody?
I think that's a little too far to have to go to see it.
I think so.
I appreciate their efforts, but I don't think I'm going to be able to make that.
Now, has everybody heard about the Gunsmoke auction on November 15th?
No. Yes.
Greg, we haven't.
Well, okay. Well, let me tell you, Julian's will be holding a Gunsmoke and Western Legends auction featuring 568 lots. 230 of them are from the James Arness estate. It includes costumes, badges, guns, saddle scripts. I interviewed Janet Arness for INSP about the auction. That blog will be up any day now, but I already have one posted called Bid on a Piece of Gunsmoke History that links to the auction catalog and shows you how to register to bid. And there are also many items from the estates of Dennis Weaver, who played Chester, and Burt Reynolds, who played Quint. Now, for all of you contemporary Western fans, there's an actor named Robert Taylor. Not the one who was at MGM in the 30s and 40s.
Who? What's his name again?
Robert Taylor.
Robert. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's an Australian. Hangman. Yeah, The Hangman. And let's see, there were a couple of Roman movies that he did. Like, right. Yeah, I remember him, yeah.
Right. And and he has a new Australian Western series called Territory on Netflix. Has anyone caught it yet?
No.
We've
been
spin-off,
seeing him,
you know,
on the Origins NCIS series.
He's a very busy man these days. My excuse, of course, is I've been overseas for like the last month. And so I you know, trying to access Netflix from, you know, from France might be a little bit more difficult. And so I haven't been watching much television like that. But now that I'm back, I'm sure I'll catch an episode.
Oh, yeah, I just caught the first one today, and it was very hard not to watch the next five. But, you know, I like to spread it out. He plays the patriarch of the Lawson family, and they are fifth generation owners of the largest cattle station in Australia. The station is the size of Belgium, or of Yellowstone, for that matter. But anyway, I saw the first episode, and as I say, it's very good. My only complaint is some of the accents are so Australian and thick that I kind of wanted subtitles, but I didn't want to admit my hearing's gone. Now, actor Thomas Jane is set to star in Frontier Crucible, shooting in Monument Valley this month, directed by Travis Mills, who famously, during COVID no less, directed 12 Westerns in 12 months. It's produced by Dallas Saunier, who produced Bone Tomahawk, and he pitched this one as, it's Reservoir Dogs meets Bone Tomahawk. Also in it are Eddie Spears, and Armie Hammer has just signed on. And finally, in 3 days, on November 10th, cameras roll in the Western movie town of Gammon's Gulch outside of Benson, Arizona, for Billy the Kid, Blood and Legend, starring Costas Mandalore as Pat Garrett and Calder Griffith as Billy. It's directed by Michael Pfeiffer, whose seven previous Westerns include Shooting Star, Catch the Bullet, Desperate Riders, and The Last Shootout. I've been on set for a few of those, and boy, am I bummed, because Michael offered me the role of Ash Upson, the reporter who ghostwrote Pat Garrett's memoir. But schedule-wise, I just can't do it. I will have an interview with Michael in next week's Henry's Western Roundup. And, you know, you can read all about this and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
And in every issue of True West Magazine.
All right. I don't have that issue yet. I hope I will.
Well, your article, Pat Garrett and Bill and the Kids in there. So.
Oh, that's right. 50th anniversary of the film.
Yeah, so we'll hold it up again so you know what you're looking for when you go to your local independent bookstore.
The Borders. Shot... Yes.
You know, Henry, I want to ask you a question about that article, Garrett and Billy the Kid. Yeah, we gave the role of Billy, I think, to Chris Christopherson.
Right.
But it seems like that Bob Dylan was considered. And why wasn't he, you remember why he didn't get the role?
Well, actually, no, Bob, I don't, I was not told definitively that he wasn't considered. But what happened was when Chris Christopherson signed on, being, of course, a musician at that time, even much more than an actor, he suggested Bob Dylan come in to work on the music. So Dylan came in that way, and at that point, he started saying to Sam Peckinpah, hey, why don't you give him a part? And so Billy the Kid was already cast at the point.
Got it. Well, Henry, thank you so much for sharing Henry's Western Roundup. We know all the important things that are happening right now. Now we're delighted to have Craig Johnson, kind of taking center stage. Henry, of course, is also here with us through the whole show. And I know he was as delighted and thrilled by this book, Tooth and Claw, which we're going to talk about in a little greater detail in a couple minutes. But first, I think Jim has a little bio just for those of you that don't know who Craig Johnson is. You will know after tonight.
Take a little time here. Craig Johnson is the New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels, which are the basis for Longmire, the hit Netflix original drama. The books have won multiple awards, including the Wyoming Historical Association's Book of the Year, Woupri 813, working on my French here, Western Writers of America Spur Award, the Mountains and Plains Book of the Year, the SNCF Prix du Polar, Publishers Weekly Best Book of the Year, the Watson Award, Liberty Journal's Best Mystery of the Year, the Rocky, Will Rogers Award for Fiction, Spirit of Steambrook, was selected by the Wyoming State Library as the inaugural One Book Wyoming. You know, the only thing on here is not on here is a Pulitzer. Is that coming?
Yeah, where's the Pulitzer?
I don't know. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I'll leave that to the heavy hitters like Steinbeck and Hemingway.
It says Mr. Johnson lives in the large Wyoming city of Ucross, population 26. You know, I pulled that up on the web here before the show. And the only thing I
didn't believe me. Wait a minute, I'm gonna check this out. Like,
got to be 27.
I was trying to find out if you had a coffee shop or something, but you got this red barn that's an art gallery. So,
the Ucross Foundation, which is like a kind of a famous, very, very famous, actually, like at an artist's residency program like that they've had like that since the 1960s, and it's like a 15,000 acre ranch like that, you know, and they've got all these little stone cottages and everything, and they invite artists from all over the world to come and spend time like that here in Wyoming. And I live about a quarter of a mile from them, but I never got an invitation like that, so I'm kind of low brow over here on the wrong side of the track in our little town of 26 feet.
Well, we're just so delighted to have you. We just can't even tell you how delighted we are that you're with us.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us just a little bit about your writing background, and I'd like to also know how you met Walt Longmire.
Oh, well, I mean, that I laugh about it like that because the way it came to be was, is I come from a family of storytellers, really, really spectacular storytellers, and I was the worst one. And so, you know, I thought, okay, well, if I can't say them, you know, maybe I could write them down. And so I started writing like at a relatively young age like that, but, you know, wanting to be a writer, it's kind of like wanting to be an astronaut. I mean, the odds against you are so great. Just don't tell anybody so you don't embarrass yourself, but for goodness sake. And so I didn't. I kind of kept it to myself, you know, over the years. And then you know, I had an education like that, and some of it in writing. And then I just, you know, but all of that, you know, studying writing like that and attempting to be a writer and all that is all fine and well. But in the final analysis, you have to have something to write about. And I guess, you know, I got to, you know, well, the place I'm speaking to you now, like at the ranch here in Ucross, I built myself. Because I had one of those fathers, you know, that had ran construction companies and figured you were slave labor until you escaped. Look at, and so I'd learned how to do, you know, basic plumbing and electricals, look at, you know, and rough carpentry and masonry and all that kind of stuff. And so, which was a good thing because there wasn't anybody to hire, you know, out here, you know, to build the place. I had to kind of do it myself. And so, you know, Judy and I, you know, I built the first part of the house and we were here. And then I went in and tore out an old opera house in Sheridan and got her store all up and going like that. And, you know, and I decided, I thought, well, what the heck, you know, if I'm going to, you know, if I'm going to write a book, now would be the time to sit down and write a book. And that was about 20 years ago, like a little more than 20 years ago. And at that point in time, everything in crime fiction was noir. Everything was very dark, gritty, urban, you know, alcoholic divorced detectives burying bodies in their backyards, you know, and all of that. And I thought, you know, what if you did something different? What if you did like the sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state? That would be something that hadn't been done before. And so lo and behold, Walt Longmire was born.
So did he tap you on the shoulder when you were thinking about what to write? And he'd say, I got a story. I got a story. Tell my story. Or did he just, did you just start typing? Or how did he come on the page, Craig?
You know, I mean, the quality of that question, like that, probably the version of that I get more than anything else is there are tons of people that always ask me the question, like, well, how much of you is Walt Longmire? And yeah, my wife, yeah, Judy, actually has, you know, the best, you know, response to that, where she says that Walt Longmire is who Craig would like to be in 10 years. It's just he's off to an incredibly slow start. And, you know, I can't really argue with that like that. I mean, there are elements of Walt that I aspire to. There are things that I really enjoy about him. But then there are things about him that I'm glad that I've been able to avoid. I mean, you know, he's had a lot of tragedy in his life to make him who he is. And I've been able to successfully avoid an awful lot of those tragedies. And I don't want to pay the prices that he's had to pay to be who it is that he is. Yeah. But the books are written in first person, you know, so you're kind of in Walt's head for 350 pages. And so when I first started writing the books, it kind of dawned on me that, you know, that better be an interesting place to be. You know, he better be intelligent. He better be insightful. He better be humane. He better be dogged and smart and tough. Mm-hmm. You know, all those things like that I would like to think that I am, but know that I'm probably not. And at least not to the extent that Walt Longmire is like it. And so all of those like tumblers all kind of like fell into place, you know, to make him who he was like it. And then when I was writing that first book, The Cold Dish, in the series, like, at, you know, I kind of set it out like that because it really wasn't supposed to be a series at all. It was just supposed to be a standalone book. And when you read that first Walt Longmire book, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, you know, whenever Viking Penguin came back after they purchased it, you know, and they said, you know, well, you know, we'd really like some more of these. And I had to think about it. You know, I had to think about, you know, it's daunting, you know, to think about starting a series, you know, because you don't know how long that series could go. I mean, there are series that have gone 40, 50 books, for goodness sake. Like it. And so you're basically, you know, tying yourself to that for maybe perhaps the rest of your life. Like it. And so the big question became, well, do these characters have more stories to tell? And I have to admit that one of the dirty little secrets about my books, of course, is that all of the stories come from newspaper articles, every single one of them. Like I can go back and find the seminal newspaper article, you know, that I use, you know, as the catalyst, you know, for every single one of, you know, these books. I got to know Henry must enjoy hearing that like that, because, you know, what keeps the books done is it keeps them grounded in a reality of the American West. I mean, we've all read or seen movies or television shows like that where we're sitting there watching these things and we're like, there's no way that could ever possibly happen. It's just so unbelievable. And it's a little insulting for those of us that actually live in the American West. And so, you know, what those newspaper articles do is they keep it grounded in a reality. And so Walt is actually dealing with the things, you know, that Western sheriffs are dealing with. And it also gives me a grounded ability to deal with social issues like that and problems like that we in the West, you know, actually do confront.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into the amazing mm-hmm. edge of the seat thriller, I want to just take a moment and talk about this particular book, which you won a couple of major awards for last year, The Longmire Defense. Congratulations on the 2024 Spur Award given by Western Writers. It was fun to see you there at the conference. And also just recently, the Will Rogers Gold Medallion for the same book. So congratulations.
Thank you. That's and two Glenn, organizations that, like, you know, I have a great deal of respect for. I mean, the Western Writers of America, and of course, like at the, you know, the Will Rogers Medallion Award. I mean, those are two groups like at that the names that are involved, you know, in the long and storied history is, you know, pretty wonderful, I have to admit. Yes. And I will never tire of hearing my name, you know, compared to Louis L'Amour and Zane Grey and of course, you know, Will Rogers, like that, you know, because it's kind of like what you were saying before, as far as the humor is concerned. Mm. Like, I mean, now he's one of the greatest humorists of all time.
Oh, you read absolutely. A lot of his
political commentary and everything he said, you know, more than like, you know, 90 years ago is still the same today. Like, there's a brutal honesty like that to his work that I absolutely love. And so I'll never tire of hearing that.
This year you released First Frost.
Mm-hmm.
Did you enter it for a Spur Award? You don't have to answer that.
Publishers do that. Like
They don't
allow lowly authors like that to do that kind of, you know, that kind of entree. Like, and so, yeah, but I'm pretty sure like that probably Viking Penguin, you know, put it in for, you know, the Western Writers and all the other awards too. Like that. They're pretty good about that, I have to admit. But yeah, that was a different book, I have to admit.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I picked this book up. We obviously didn't have time to read a second book, but we kind of get into this a little bit. I think this is when he gets in a fight with a guy called Lester.
Yes.
That fight must have went on for about an hour.
He gets into a fight with him a couple of times. You might be attaching all those fights together. It was one of those situations like that where, you know, every time he sees Lester, Lester wants to fight him. And, you know, and Walt's like, I don't want to fight you like that. But then, you know, he ends up beating Lester up. You know, well, Lester is the small town bully. Like, and so every chance he gets, he wants to refight Walt. Like, and so after a while, Walt's like, you know, I got to get out of this town because I'm getting worn out, for goodness sake. Like, and so, but that was the interesting thing. Like, that was because, you know, if Walt, you know, were, you know, like, as he is, like in the books, like at an elderly age, like I wouldn't put him through that like that. But Walt, in this particular book, the book takes place in 1964. Like, so Walt is like 22 years old. He's been playing, you know, he's been an offensive lineman for USC who won a Rose Bowl that year. You know, I mean, he's in absolute peak physical condition. He's like about 6'5". He weighs about 250 some pounds. It's solid muscle. And so that was kind of the fun part of writing that book, to see Walt and Henry at kind of the absolute peak of their physical prowess. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the opposite side of that coin is that they're 22 years old. So, yeah, they're at the peak of their physical prowess, but they're not very smart. Okay. And so they make a lot of mistakes and a lot of bad things happen to them along the way. I think one of my favorite quotes in the book was the one where, you know, Walt, in all his naivete, you know, turns to Henry and says, you know, well, you know, maybe we should, you know, report this to the authorities. And Henry's response is, when has that ever worked out for us? You know?
Well, and I also only could read a little bit of it, but they're surfing.
There
you know,
is.
They're surfing. And is. I'm picturing, you know, Walt surfing. They're
absolutely. Henry, back me up on this. How much surfing did James Arnaz do in Southern California?
The whole reason he kept doing Gunsmoke was so he could get out early and surf.
So he could surf.
There we go.
Exactly. And I couldn't help but have sort of, I kind of had Jim Arnaz laying on. I know it's Longmire, but I'm like, oh my, I'm going to put,
they have a lot in
I got
common.
Jim Arnaz right there on that surfboard.
They have a lot in common physically, a lot of different things. It was hilarious. I can't remember where it was, but there was like some blog or something that I was reading. And there was a famous surfer like that who, you know, was surfing there, you know, in Southern California, there in LA, around Malibu or something. And he said, you know, that he, you know, got, you know, caught, you know, in a riptide and finally got out of the water. It was freezing cold. And he said there was a camper, you know, a camper truck, you know, up on the one. And, you know, he hauled himself up there, got that far, like, and the guy looked at him and said, well, here, threw a blanket around him, had a stew that he was cooking over a fire and everything. And, you know, fed him, like, it made sure he was okay and everything, he could get to his car and get home and all this kind of stuff like that. And, you know, I can't remember what it was like that, but I think like a week later, you know, his, you know, parents were watching Gunsmoke and he looked and he goes, that was the guy. Like, that's the guy that saved me out on Malibu, out on Point Doom, for gosh sake.
That's so funny. We're going to take a very short break. We want you, our listeners, to know one of the places that you can get all of Craig's books and also Henry's book and all of the featured guests on Rendezvous with a Writer. And that is the Out West Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. And when we come back, it's going to be all about Tooth and Claw. Stay tuned.
Thing. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest, Henry Park.
And
Craig Johnson. You know, I think at this point we thought maybe you were going to read something, but before you do that, Craig, you remember what is a bear attack proverb?
Proverb.
I do. There are two quotes in the book. Like that one actually does to go with the, you know, with the title of the book. Like that, it's of course the memorum of AHH by Alfred, Lord Tennyson. And it's that wonderful quote, who trusted God was love indeed and love creation's final law. The nature read in tooth and claw with writhe and shrieked against this creed. It basically does a comparison contrast, you know, between, you know, the human construct of justice and all of that, like that, and humanity, civilization, and all that, and compares it, you know, with the roughshod, you know, aspects of the natural world, you know, both red of tooth and claw. And so when I was thinking about this book, there really wasn't any question as to what the title, you know, was going to have to be. Definitely tooth and claw. And then, of course, yeah, the bear attack proverb actually. It actually came from my nephew, who I was talking to one day, and he said, well, you know, there's an old proverb about the color of the bear. Look at, and I said, well, what's that? And he goes, if it's black, fight back. If it's brown, lay right down. If it's white, say goodnight.
Dinner.
All right, so you're, would you like a reading? Is that what I'm hearing?
Love a reading.
Okay, well, now I'm going to be honest with you. Like that, you know, the good news is this is the very first reading that I'm doing, you know, from Tooth and Claw. Like that's the good news. The bad news is this is the very first reading that I'm doing, you know, from Tooth and Claw. All right,
we understand.
Low, all right, let's not get
all
too
right. Bring it on. Bring it on.
It won't be over rehearsed.
Yeah, absolutely. No. The improvisational, you know, in the moment, you know, aspect is going to be fully, you know, in display. This is actually at the beginning of chapter two. Like, you know, as the book starts out, like that, it's actually in the modern day, and Walt and Henry are, you know, at Lucian's, you know, home for assisted living, like at having a steak dinner like that. And that somehow the, you know, the subject of bears comes up, and then polar bears come up like it. And of course, Lucian doesn't really believe that like Walt and Henry have had any interactions with like, you know, polar bears. And as it turns out, they have. And so they begin telling the story like that. And it's kind of bookends, you know, the story to a great extent. But this is from chapter two like that. And this is the part where Walt is in a very kind of like dark place. This is after the Vietnam War. He's been, you know, sentenced to go to the Johnston Atoll, you know, for another 4 months by the provost marshal, the Marine Corps, just to get him out of Vietnam. And he ends up there like that, you know, and then finally, when he's discharged like that, he ends up going to Alaska, and he states to Henry that he was just looking for a place to cool off was what he was doing. Like, and of course, boy, that North Slope in Prudhomme Bay, that's a place to cool off in the wintertime. Cool. Two ways about it. So he ends up there. But the problem is, of course, that he's drinking a great deal too much. And so his future wife, Martha, sends Henry, Standing Bear, out on a kind of intervention to go up there and kind of like wrestle the bottle away from Walt. Like at, and during the time that he's up there for this visit, they get the opportunity to go out on this national survey like that. And they have to head out on one of these bush planes, like at a C-119 boxcar. That sends them off. And this is that section here where they're on the plane going out to this one spot in the ice where they have to do these core samplings. Okay, so if you're ready, I am.
All right.
Okay. Airborne, Nesquit, North Slope, Alaska, December 22nd, 1970. Thunder Polar Pig was what they called her, and with good reason. She was loud, handled like a pig, and most of the guys said that they dated her. She was a faded powder blue, and everyone assumed that she was a cast-off from the United Nations, which she was. The C-119 flying boxcar, a World War II-developed military transport, was famous for its clamshell openings in the back, where a thiokol buggy sat chained to the floor. The Snowcat was something vintage, too, but a darker shade of blue, leading everyone to believe that it was a cast-off from Sunoco, which it was. For purposes of weight balance, the cat was forward, and the seven of us sat in the paratrooper seats in the back, facing one another in our immersion suits, which guaranteed to keep you alive in frigid water at least for a couple of hours longer than if you weren't wearing one. I've been told that the clamshell doors of the C-119 seal, but they don't. They just kind of close enough to keep you from falling out. It was a freezing cold back there, and in our immersion suits and parkas, you couldn't tell who was who, but I already knew all of them but one. Henry, Roy Carlisle, the navigator, Mattingly, the radio man and flight engineer, the company man, Marco Vasquez, and the spotter shooter, Blackjack, and the USGS survey guy I knew only by his unique nickname. The pilot, Mike Bergstrom, and Jerry Boyle, the co-pilot, were up front. I looked through the periscope of fox fur surrounding my tightened hood and found Henry seated in the tub beside me with the hood of his M3B lowered. Is it everything you hope for in your wildest dreams? His eyes shifted to mine, but his head didn't move as he shouted back to be heard over the two Pratt & Whitney 14-cylinder engines that fought to carry us towards Santa Claus and the North Pole. More. Unbuttoning just enough to pull the metal flask from the mottled sealskin parka I wore over the immersion suit, which I had also inherited from my dead predecessor, I couldn't help but notice how much surplus surrounded us. It made me feel like I was back in the military. In a sense, the military or the big oil companies were the only ones who could afford to transport equipment like this to the ends of the world. My musings were broken as my attention was drawn to the individual sitting farthest from us, his hands folded around a 416-bore Rigby, a high-powered rifle with a massive scope that he cradled between his legs. Blackjack was all I knew him by, and I wasn't sure if it was a nickname, a proper name, a first name or last name, or if it was an alias. He was a legend among the tight-knit group of professionals who made their living on the North Slope. In a world of renowned spotters, Black Jack was the best at what he did, and what he did was keep polar bears from devouring you while you did your work. When we'd gotten on the plane to Nesquit, we had already been in here with geologists from the U.S. Geological Survey. I'd waved to the small man, but he didn't move, and it was only later that I'd conclude that he was asleep. He wasn't sleeping now, and I still could see his face, but I couldn't tell the way his head was cocked that he was watching me through his large yellow-tinted goggles. I unscrewed the top from the metal flask with an Art Deco design on the side and lifted it in salute, but he simply turned his head towards the side window of the revolving propellers, which threw ice off in chunks that echoed against the fuselage. Shrugging, I took a sip and then became aware of a gloved hand reaching across the cargo space. I lowered the flask and reached out to hand it to a skinny young USGS team leader called Wormy by his co-workers. I yelled to be heard over the clamor of the engines. What they call you? Is that a nickname or a condition? Staring at myself in the reflection of his snow goggles, I watched as his lips parted and his struggling beard, revealing a crooked but white teeth. A nickname, because I work with worms. I handed him the flask, which he took and upended before handing it back to me, sputtering in a New England accent. "That's terrible. What is it?" I lowered my balaclava and shouted back, "A mixture of all the bottles that were left in my predecessor's desk." I took it back and tucked it away. "We call it Polar Pit." He nodded. "Truth in advertising." "Yeah, but if you do have worms, that ought to kill them."
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
You know, Craig, so much of this book demands to be read aloud.
Oh, thank you.
Wait, did you listen to this? We just, you know, it's just fabulous that way. So let's see. So we have to get back to business. Hold on. There's something about story time, you know. We all get so involved in it, don't we?
That's why we're here. That's why we do what we do.
We have a lot of points here. Go ahead.
And you can probably tie them all together. I think we got the artist circle, we got a polar bear, we get a spotter.
Yeah.
Ice worms. We got the U.S. Geological Survey. We got the Beaufort Geyer.
Geyer.
And we got a ghost ship. You put them all together.
Yeah, you tie it all together. So how did you find all of these interesting storylines? And then, of course, you knit them together so beautifully.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Like, I think that a lot of it was like, you know, I tend to, my research is kind of like, I tend to refer to it as the mountain stream version of research, in the sense that, you know, like I go along and I read everything, you know, like, and I pick all of these things up, and I don't do a lot of notes whenever I'm doing research for a book. What I tend to do like that is when I get ready to write that book, what I remember is what needs to be in that book. Those are the aspects that are different, that might be a little more unique. You know, I don't ever want to just, you know, regurgitate the same information and all that kind of stuff. So for me, it's always a question of like, okay, well, what would be interesting? And what do I remember about that I didn't know before? That's what I want to carry on to the reader. And this, a lot of it, you know, a lot of this material, like, you know, has been going on since I was a kid. You know, there actually was like, you know, an article that I remember reading. And one of my dad's, you know, magazine, my dad never, you know, remember that era when nobody threw away magazines? You kept magazines. Hey, they were kept.
We got them.
You remember from 7 years ago, you want to go back and you want to read that. I mean, before the internet, I mean, that's, I think, what a lot of it, you know, had a large scale effect like that. But that was like that personal library, you know, that everybody had. Like, and so one of my favorite quotes, I think it was from Irma Bombeck, where she said, "No person that ever could read was ever successful in cleaning out an attic," you know, because you know, you'd get up there and you'd like, "Oh, look, that's a good book. I remember that. Oh, look, remember this copy of this magazine? This was, I got to read that article again." Pretty soon, you're just sitting there reading like it for 8 hours, for goodness sake. Like, and so there was actually in the World News magazine, there was a big article about the, you know, famous Arctic ghost ship, you know, of the SS Beishimo. And I remember reading that when I was a teenager. I mean, like, you know, preteen, like 14, 15 years old, like I was just blown away by the fact that this ship had been like floating around up there, you know, all the way since like, you know, World War One, for goodness sake, and hadn't sunk, you know. And I just thought, you know, this is amazing. You know, if I ever get the chance to utilize this in a storyline, that would be kind of cool. And, you know, whenever I started thinking about this book in itself, you know, with the whole, you know, Alistair MacLean kind of quality that it was supposed to have. And it's funny, like that for me, like that, because I've been to a couple of different like literary festivals and library events. And I'll mention this book, you know, because it's, of course, the next book that's coming out. And I'll mention something about Alistair MacLean. And I'm so stunned whenever so many readers look at me and go, "Who?" I mean, this guy sold millions and millions of books in the period of time, you know, that he was writing. And I mean, you know, to go back to Henry's, you know, milieu, like that, I have to say, like that, if he made a grocery list, they made a movie out of it, for goodness sake. Like, but then, of course, you know, whenever nobody remembers who Alistair MacLean is, all you have to do is say Ice Station Zebra, Guns of Navarone, Where Eagles Dare, you know, and then suddenly, you know, their eyes light up and they're like, "Oh, okay, now I get it," like that. But he was spectacular in what he did. You know, he did those, you know, machismo, thriller writings with breakneck paces with really interesting characters, lots of twists and turns. You know, he kept you guessing all the way through till the very bitter end, you know, or the beautiful end, you know, of his books. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was what I was shooting for when I was writing to
you.
And when I wrote it, you know, I mean, I wrote it because I started this book about 5 years ago. And it just stopped on me. I just thought, okay, something's wrong. The tone is not working. You know, the structure is not working. And like, you know, what you do sometimes is just like put it back in the folder and set it away. And then I started digging back through like at my notes and found all that information about Alistair MacLean. And I thought, that's what happened. You forgot that this was an Alistair MacLean, you know, style of book with the tone and feel. And so I went back like and dug back through it and started in on it again. And then it all fell into place. But one of the key elements was that ship, like just simply because otherwise this would have been one of those big manhunt, you know, or man versus nature books out there on the ice, you know. Well, you know, like Studs Terkel used to say, nothing ever happened nowhere. And, you know, I think that, you know, you've got to have an interesting environment, you know, for those books. I mean, one of the reasons I believe, you know, like for the success of the Longmire series, like at both the you know, the books and the television series, is that, you know, an awful lot of people have not been to the High Plains, you know, the border country between Montana and Wyoming, like, but yet there's an appeal. And so they want to know what it's like. Certainly, you know, I mean, I just got back from a European tour that was about a month long. A lot of people around the world are still very interested in that part of the world, certainly in the contemporary American West, and want to know what's going on now. For them, that's great interest. And so I knew I needed an environ for that book. And, you know, I happened to think back and remembered that, you know, that magazine article about the SS Beishimo. And I was like, that's
there
it.
There you go.
There you go. And ice worms.
Like, I mean, who is interested in ice worms?
Throw these things at us when it's like, go ship it. Ice worms.
I know. Then, whenever that part like that, wherever Walt's asking them why it is that they're doing this, you know, and he starts explaining about the ice worms, like, you know, and Walt's like, well, you know what? Can't we just put them in a Miller's, you know, in a Miller's coffee can, like that? And Jeremy's like, oh no, they emulsify, they melt, you know, and you know, in natural temperatures. And Walt's like, you know, just when I thought you couldn't like make it any worse, this subject matter, you've gone ahead and made it even worse, like, you know. And then there's a part, of course, like where they discover the bear. You know, this bear is out there, you know, on the ice, and they're in that thiacol, like, you know, and, you know, it's like Spam in a can is what it is. I mean, that thing's going to come over and open that thing up and have lunch is what it's going to do. And so Walt's like, well, why don't we go a quarter of a mile that way and do the, you know, the ice core worm testing, you know, or, you know, and he's like, no, we can't. A lot of years of, you know, a lot of research, you know, went into discovering this exact spot. And Walt's like, you're telling me that this little stretch of ice is different from that little stretch of ice, you know, a quarter of a mile to the right or the left or forward or back. Like that. And he's like, okay, whatever. Like that. That's what we'll do. Like that. We'll go in a long circle, you know, because I think, you know, the thiacol can go exactly 1 mile faster than the polar bear can, like that. And so, you know, they have to wear him out, like that, to get away from him a little bit, you know, but he loses interest pretty quick. And yeah. And then of course, as things go, you know, they end up meeting him again.
We are talking about Tooth and Claw. We're going to step away for one more moment. If you are a writer, we want you to take a look at what Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison have available to you. They are sponsors of this show, and we love them. And here is a word from Blue Cottage Agency. Stay tuned. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experienced, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guests, Amy Park and Craig Johnson. We're talking about Tooth and Claw here. You know, we want to ask one or two questions about characters, Craig. But first, do any of these folks ever surprise you? Do they go out on their own? Do you have to bring them back?
You know, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that question, like that, and also that theory, because I often, like, you know, will hear, you know, authors say, you know, well, I just, you know, just go in the room and the characters take over and they do what they want to do. I don't know about you guys, but people who go in rooms by themselves and hear voices kind of worry me a little bit. I don't know. Obviously, you know, my wife, once again, I keep quoting my wife, Judy, like that, but she's pretty much a font of an awful lot of knowledge. And one of the statements she made was, is like, well, Craig's the only one in the room, you know? And so I think what you have to do is you have to take certain aspects of your own personality, facets of your own character, and then spin them off to, you know, to make other characters. And then there's also that great quote that I utilize all the time by Wallace Stegner, like at the magnificent Stanford program writing teacher, who had, you know, such layabout, you know, students as Larry McMurtry and Ken Kesey and people like that. And one of his famous quotes was, it's actually in his book on writing and teaching fiction, where he says, the greatest piece of fiction ever written is the disclaimer at the beginning of every book that says nobody in this book is based off anybody alive or dead. And what a crock that is. Like that. I mean, that's your job, to go find interesting people and populate your novels with them like that. And so, you know, of course that can be a dangerous thing when you live in a state that only has 5,000 people in it, you know, but nonetheless, like that. I think that's one of the joys, like I think, of what it is that we do, and trying to differentiate those characters, you know. And then for me, and another big strong aspect of it is whenever I'm teaching classes with students, like that, you know, they'll always be very caught up on the physicality of their characters. You know, they're very, very interested in how they look. And I'm always looking at them and going, you do know that you're only going to describe that character one time. Okay. Now they're going to talk all the way through that novel like that. And so if you really want to focus on something, you need to focus on their voice is what you need to focus on. Each voice, you know, needs to be so completely different with, you know, the tone, the use of language, the cadence, you know, vocabulary, all those things like that. And I think that that's a key element like that to every single one of those characters. What's the voice?
I'm looking at time. Oh, so Henry, jump in.
Thank you. I just, actually, let me quick say, I promised Jerry Christina that I would say hi.
And Jerry, if you're watching, we miss you and love you.
I was wondering, in terms of you know, establishing the voice of your characters, why you decided that Henry Standing Bear would never use contractions.
That's actually a pretty funny, I think it's a funny story. Like it actually, because once again, like you know, all of the characters are based off of real people like that. And you know, a lot of the native characters in my books are all based off of friends, you know, neighbors, some of them family, up on the Northern Cheyenne, the Crow Reservation. And Henry is based off a very good friend of mine, Marcus Red Thunder. And I have to admit that we were in an event one time, like at doing it together. And I noticed that, like, as the event went on, he started slipping into this, like, B-movie Indian patois, like that was, you know, with no contractions, you know, and all this, like, and I remember getting to the end of the evening, like, and looking at him as we went off stage, like, I turned and looked at him and I said, what was that all about? Like, I mean, no contractions, what's that about? And he just looked at me and he goes, it's just to piss white people off is all it is. Like, and so, that was pretty funny. And so I thought, okay, whenever I was putting, you know, Henry together, you know, I thought, okay, he's very, very careful about every aspect, you know, of his existence. And I thought the way he speaks would also, it wouldn't be lazy. It would be very careful and a cultivated speech pattern that he would use. And it makes him, you know, very, very noticeable within the books. You know, when he talks, you know which character he is. I don't use the phrases he said, she said, or Henry said, or Walt said, or anything like that. I'd much rather use like a physical action where Walt straightens his hat, you know, or Henry, you know, touches the, you know, the collar of his shirt or something like that. And then let the hopefully like a, the individuality of the language of the characters convey who it is that's speaking.
I'm looking at time. Craig, you're starting out on a book tour. Where can people find all the information so they don't miss you?
Absolutely. It's on, probably the best place to go to like that for information would be CraigAllenJohnson.com. CraigAllenJohnson.com. Like, and we have a section on that website that's called Tour of Duty. And, you know, we're bouncing around for like about 2.5 weeks. Okay? And so it should be a fun little tour. It kind of encompasses Thanksgiving, But we've also got two daughters and a granddaughter back in Philadelphia. And so we'll be having Thanksgiving dinner before I head back out on the road again.
Jim, do you have a quick quote? I'm looking at our time running out.
Oh, my goodness. You know, one of our characters, he's actually the pilot of the plane. His name is Bergstrom. He and Longmire are having a conversation. And he's got Longmire composition position. But he says, why are you smiling? And Longmire says, it's something I told Wormy about. How money is power, and power is money. And if you yank back the bed sheets at midnight, you're going to find both of them in the bed together. And that's in the book a couple times.
Yes. Well, we want to thank everybody for being with us. Next week, tune in for In the Limelight. We will have guest Jan D. Payne with a really wonderful kind of thriller mystery, Rabbit Moon. And then taking center stage is Preston Lewis and Harriet Kosher Lewis. And we'll be doing two of their wonderful books about cattails and their brand new, just released Pint-Sized Pioneers. And that's next week. And we just thank both of you gentlemen for being with us. We are out of time. What do you want to say?
It's always a great day out west.
We'll see you down the road. Gentlemen. Bye.
Bye, everybody.